This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement, as we look back at the second half of a thoroughly entertaining season that's provided us with more thrills and spills than an intoxicated waiter. Just the sort of fare that makes the English Football League so hopelessly addictive. If you've been listening and subscribing since we kicked off in August, then thank you for your company. And as we enter the close season before we go again in August, it felt like a good time for a little retrospective look back on some of the most notable and memorable interviews we've done so far this calendar year. At Christmas, we brought you our Best of the Guests Part 1 from the 2021-22 season, so no prizes for guessing what this episode's called. Sit back, relax, and fingers crossed, enjoy our Best of the Guests Part 2 on this special edition of the Official EFL Podcast. We kick off our season end roundup by rewinding the clock back to the end of the January transfer window, where Bournemouth were one of the busiest clubs, bringing in seven new faces. One of those was midfielder Todd Cantwell, arriving on loan from Norwich City. He gave us a brutally honest assessment of the circumstances that led to him leaving his beloved Norfolk and joining up with Scott Parker's team, who had a return to the top flight firmly in their sights. When did you know you're on the move, and when did you know it was going to be Bournemouth? Because I read Olympiacos, I read Granada. There was rumours of a couple of Premier League clubs being in for you. But when did you know the deal was going to happen?
I think, respectfully, I knew a while ago. I think for whatever reason, you know, things didn't materialise the way I had planned this season. And that's just honest, you know, and I found myself in this position. But as a footballer, you have to react to these things. You know, you can't sit there, you can't rest on it. I think everyone's aware of football careers. You know, every ex-player I've ever spoken to says absolutely flies by. And, you know, you've got so many players from so many different places around the world that, you know, it's just a fresh batch every time the older bunch kind of fizzle out. So for me, the most important thing in my career is playing football. To answer your question about kind of when and how, there was very much a strong possibility that I'd be going abroad for the majority of the window. There was interest from Premier League clubs. You know, nothing materialised in the sense that, you know, anything was on the table ready to go. But as everyone knows in England, deadline day becomes a very sort of interesting day, which I've obviously watched as a kid and then obviously felt this time. So Bournemouth was pretty late in the window. I had a conversation with the manager here. And to be honest, it felt like a really easy decision after that conversation. It wasn't something that I had planned for by any means. But listening to the manager, knowing the manager, knowing what the manager did as a player, and like I say, everything he spoke to me on the phone just completely concreted my mind that this was the right move for me at this stage of my career. And, you know, there's a goal here, which is to go up. And if we can do it winning the title, then, you know, it's the extra bonus. And that's definitely something I want. You know, I want to win. It kills me to lose. So I think it just felt like a really good fit.
The notion of talking late to Bournemouth. I mean, are we talking Saturday? Are we talking Sunday? Are we talking Monday morning? You woke up and did not know where you were going to be sleeping that night. Literally like that.
Yeah, I found out on Saturday that it was something that could potentially happen. And like I say, you know, I very, very soonly followed by a conversation with the manager. And yeah, from there, it materialised enough for me to make my way down on the Monday. And then, yeah, we got the paperwork done pretty late.
Listen, you want to move on. I don't see any point in raking over some of the previous embers. But do you feel you've got something to prove? Maybe something to prove to a previous manager, previous managers, to supporters?
Honestly, no, I don't. I know what it is that I bring. And respectfully, outside noise to me has just become a blur. So, you know, if the direct communication and bits and pieces that I have directly with the club are not right, one, it stays internal anyway. And two, you know what you believe is right and wrong and the truth and whatever. So for me, the most important thing I've always said to myself as a footballer, I'll always be honest with myself. So I'll always be self-critical. And I'll always, you know, stay true to myself and remain the person that I want to be. I've done that throughout my process. Like I say, things haven't gone as planned. I think most people probably realise that it's not something that will shock everyone. But yeah, I think for me, it's just getting back to playing, getting back to providing what I want to provide for my teammates. And I'm desperate to get another title. You know, that you're not here to not want to win games. You're not at a club like Bournemouth if you don't want to try and clinch the title. So for me, that's my sole aim.
Do you know where he's going to play you?
I've got an idea, but that would be telling.
Okay, thanks for that. Well, that's it's a good job. I wasn't looking for that answer to fill the last 3 minutes of the interview.
You have to get up pretty early to get that out of me.
Well, that's me till then, eh? We must say congratulations to Bournemouth for a fantastic season and their return to the Premier League. Of course, not every team can achieve their promotion aim to Sky Bet League One now, and a side who sadly missed out in the playoff final a couple of weeks ago. But it's still been an impressive campaign for Gareth Ainsworth, Wickham Wanderers. We spoke to one of the club's longest serving and most loyal servants, Matt Bloomfield, who was forced to retire this year after an incident that made him take stock of his priorities. It's a story that should serve as a lesson to all within the game. We need to have a serious chat, and that chat is that your career was finally over as a result of, well, it feels like a bizarre incident in a game in the League Cup, wasn't it, against Exeter last August. Do you want to just take us through it? Because I know you're very keen for football authorities to make some changes, you know, maybe as a result of your own insights and experiences.
Yeah, to give it a little bit of context, I guess I should mention that I've had probably 4 concussions in the last 4 years before August the 10th, 2021. And each one I recovered absolutely fine. Within a few days, I felt great, desperate to get back on the football pitch, but followed all the protocols that led the 7-day return to play. Or if I was knocked out, it was longer. But each time I felt absolutely fine, but followed all the protocols. Then we went down to Exeter. I got left out of the first game of the season against Accrington. So I was heading down to Exeter to prove a point to the gaffer, to prove a point to the coaching staff, and to prove a point to myself that at 37, I had another season in me at least. I prepared like I could. I was gutted when I wasn't picked for the first league game of the season. So I went down there to play, to win, to play well, and get back in the team. That was my only sort of thoughts. And then we got a free kick on the halfway line. And as we do, we sort of play long from these situations. So I was walking away and JJ tried to take a quick free kick, and by total accident, hit me on the back of the head with a ball that knocked me over, and immediately I knew that I didn't feel great. The world was spinning. You know, I knew where I was and everything, but the doctor and the physio came on and took me off immediately. I was trying to walk to the tunnel, and the Wickham fans were just on the right, and I kept veering across, and so I knew I couldn't. I was struggling to get straight back to the tunnel, and then the doctor told me after, it's quite narrow at Exeter, and I was sort of hitting both sides of the wall, and I felt agitated, irritated, emotional. I had a headache and dizzy, and I knew I wasn't feeling too great. So showing all the signs of a concussion, I guess. And as the doctor told me afterwards, it's not always the head collisions where you're tense and you're waiting for the knock. That was a concussion that you would suffer from, because your body, you know, I was relaxed. I wasn't expecting anything to happen, and my head was really tilted when the ball hit me. So that's what happened, and immediately I knew that I was feeling rough, and you know, the symptoms lasted a lot longer than what they did before. That week or two that followed, I real high fatigue, low energy. You know, things that usually gave me real high delight, you know, weren't giving me such delight. I was struggling to see the light in them, and it was a scary period, Clem, if I'm honest, mate, because you know, playing a game of football and doing what I loved suddenly put me in a situation when I wasn't feeling too great, and that took a little while for that to resolve. So I'm still got issues sort of ongoing now with my balance, and you know, when I'm out on the training ground and balls are being kicked around, I'm a bit jumpy and have to be a bit careful where I stand. So, you know, it's something that happened, and I would like to use this opportunity. I don't want it to be a sob story. This is how my career ended. I want, you know, it's an opportunity to raise awareness around head injuries, and to try and help move the game forward, because there needs to be more research out there for footballers. There's not enough research on head injuries, and there needs to be more done. I my personal opinion is that the concussion substitution needs to change slightly. I would like to alter that if I'm ever listened to. And I also think that there needs to be a little bit more education to footballers around head injury, brain injury, because, you know, like, we're very driven people. We're programmed to play through injuries and to get ourselves out there on a Saturday afternoon, because our place in the team relies on it. You know, contracts rely on it, mortgages rely on it, promotions and relegations. But when it comes to your brain health, there needs to be a little bit more education around it, because I for sure didn't want to listen to the doctor. I didn't want to listen to the physio. And I was extremely fortunate that I had two people there who cared about me and wanted to do the best by me. But others might not be quite so lucky, and they may need to be a little bit more self-aware.
Longer term prognosis, you are being looked after. You are being regularly checked out. You've had whatever scans you need to. There's no nasties in there. You're very much taking care of yourself, because let's be frank, football's a brilliant game. We all love it, but it's not more important than life itself.
No. I've got, as I said earlier on, I've got a wife and two girls who mean the absolute world to me. And once I realised that I was taking a chance with my future health, and I still had symptoms and repercussions of the last one carrying over, there was, you know, I had a decision to make, but I didn't have a decision to make. There was, you know, I was advised that this is what I needed to do, and this is the process I had to take. So there's a lot of life still to live, and you know, football is a game that we all love, and it seems like it means the world at times, but it's not the be-all and the end-all. And I think at times like this, you have to sort of take a little step back and take a little grasp of reality and realise that it is only a sport. It is an income, but it's only a job. There's other jobs to do, and if the need arises, then you have to go down a different path.
This is the official EFL podcast.
And the moral of that story is, as much as we're all obsessed with football, it is just a game at the end of the day, and it's our health, safety and personal welfare that must always come first. Ryan Lowe spent more than 2 years living and working nearly 300 miles away from his family home in Liverpool when he was managing Plymouth Argyle, a club that will always hold a special place in his heart. But when the opportunity to go up a division with Preston North End and return to his native North West presented itself, it was something he felt he had to do for professional and personal reasons. Although it wasn't a decision that he made as quickly and as easily as you might imagine. Where does that decision rank in the ones you've had to make over the course of your career, Ryan?
Probably the toughest. Not a lot of people think it was, but it was. But in the same sense, it was the easiest as well, just because it was tough what we were building down there. The great, you know, bond with the board of directors, great bond with the fans, and you know, and the players first and foremost were recruited well to try and have a playoff push, which they're continuing to do, which is fair play. But then ultimately, Clem, you know, everyone wants to manage in a championship. Did I think I could get Plymouth the championship this year? There was every chance. Did I think I'd get an opportunity in a championship like within the next year or two? You'd always feel you can, but you only have to look now. Managers who lose 3, 4, 5, 6 games on the bounce, and some people are out of a job. So the decision to take the Preston job was relatively, because it was Preston and it was easy, but the decision to leave Plymouth Argyle, which what we were building, was a tough one.
Yeah. I mean, did you do kind of any weighing up of your own progression? Because it's a bit of a graveyard, isn't it? You must have seen a lot of people before you, young managers, have success at a lower league club, and then they take the leap to a bigger club and it doesn't quite work out. So there must have been certain parameters you needed to be satisfied that you'd have a fair chance of success in your new home.
Yeah, I did. I did think about it long and hard, because they always say pick your owner, not your football club. And you know, sadly, we lost our owner in Trevor Emmings, who'd been a Preston diehard for many, many years. His son now, Craig's, took over the family, and obviously Peter Ridsdale is a fantastic bloke who runs all the football departments. And you know, but I'd had opportunities to leave Plymouth Argyle before the Preston job, to be honest with you, Clem, when I was early in my 6 months, 8 months there, and I chose not to do it. I chose to stay and build, and, you know, there was one approach from a club, and then there was opportunities that would arise, and I was linked with a lot of clubs. I'd never obviously spoke to them, but, you know, my name was around there, and if I would have said, yes, I'll speak, then the opportunity would have arose, but I never, I felt I needed that time to try and get Plymouth where I felt he belonged, and that was in the top half of League One. So I'd done my time, I'd stayed and committed, but, you know, it was 2.5 years down there without the family, and you know, when this one come along, it was, as I say, it was tough to leave Plymouth Argyle because I met so many friends down there and what we were building. And fair play to Shuey now, he's continuing that on, and I wish them all the best and all the luck in the world. I'll look out for the results every Saturday. But ultimately, it was an opportunity for me to get to the Championship with another fantastic football club in Preston North End.
Listen, in the aftermath of the game at the weekend when you won at Peterborough, there's a very vivid pictures of you I can see in my head now of you doing the old punching the sort of air thing in front of the supporters. Does that in any way replicate the feeling you used to get when you put the ball in the back of the net?
No, it doesn't, to be fair. It's better. It's better.
It's better?
It's better, yeah. When I used to put the ball in the back of the net, it was a moment of, you know, I felt happiness and joy. But as a manager, you know, I'm managing, not just me, but my staff as well. You're managing 25 players. You're leaving two or three players out the squad, and you have to tell them that they're going to be out the squad and sit in the stands. And then when you put the game plan together, you know, when you're waiting for them 11, 12, 13, 14 players coming on the pitch to perform that game plan, and when they do it, it's a sigh of relief, and it's the passion in me that I love, and I want to bring that I've brought it to Preston North End. Everywhere I've done it at Plymouth Argyle, and I feel there's nothing better when you've won a game of football and you can liaise with the fans and your players to do a fist pump like that. It's a relief and a real excitement about it and a real buzz.
I do always love chatting to Ryan, as much as he won't be missing the weekly commute to Devon. I bet he's missing those pasties. In February, one particular managerial appointment raised a few eyebrows. Mark Hughes won just about all there is in the game as a player and is also highly experienced as a manager. He'd been out of work for more than 3 years after leaving Southampton, so maybe it was only a matter of time before we saw him back in the dugout. But what we didn't expect was that dugout to be at Valley Parade when he was unveiled as the new boss of Bradford City in Sky Bet League 2. A big name for a big club, and it's a big job he's taken on. Let's start this week with a man who's graced the shirts of European giants Manchester United, Barcelona and Bayern Munich, winning the Premier League, the FA Cup, the League Cup and the European Cup Winners' Cup. He's taken charge of 466 games as a Premier League manager with Blackburn Rovers, Manchester City, Fulham, QPR, Stoke City and Southampton. He's played for and managed his country, Wales. And in his fifth decade in professional football, Mark Hughes was still making the headlines last week when he signed a 2.5-year contract to take over at Sky Bet League 2 Bradford City. I'm sorry to have to get the 5 decades in there, Mark.
Yeah, I was just thinking, goodness me, you were doing well up to that point, if I'm honest.
I shocked myself a little bit, but your sort of pro career with United started in 1980, did it not? That's when you signed your pro contract.
That would be right. Yeah, I signed as a schoolboy when I was 14, and then on my 17th birthday, that's when I signed a pro contract, only for a year. And
yeah,
actually, when I worked it out, because I had to pay my digs once I signed pro, I ended up on less money than I was as an apprentice. So it wasn't a great deal that I signed.
Well, nevertheless, I were just about accurate. What sort of a reaction have you had over the last week since you were appointed?
Well, the welcome I've had from the Bradford City fans has been fantastic, I have to say. Notwithstanding the reception I had before the game, which was great, as good as any I've had. I've been at some clubs when they've wanted me out before I actually started the job. So that certainly wasn't the case at the weekend. Weren't able to get the result we all wanted, but... I've got a good feel. I think sometimes when you walk into a club, you get a sense of where the club is at, and do they really want you to do well, or are you just another manager that's coming along the way and you'll be gone soon and on to the next one? I don't get any sense of that. It's a really good, warm club that wants to do well, and they're very hopeful I can bring them success, which clearly is what I want to do for them.
And let's hope he does bring the good times back to Valley Parade. Some of you may know, as I'm always going on about it, that Middlesbrough is my hometown, and that's where my personal football allegiance lies. So I always enjoy a natter with my kindred spirits, such as fellow Teesside native Jordan Hugill. He spent the second half of the season on loan at Cardiff City. When I caught up with him, he told me about his slightly unorthodox career that used to see him working behind a bar on match days when he was playing non-league football and dreaming of his chance of one day hitting the big time.
I started at 21 at Port Vale, professionally at 21 at Port Vale, and it was initially for their, they produced like an under 23s, like development squad type thing. So it was initially for that. So that was at 21. So as you can imagine, from 16 to 21, I was playing non-league with some men who wanted to kick lumps out of me, and I recall being told that someone was going to bite my nose off.
Wow. Wow. I mean, in fairness, mate, just looking at that nose, it would be a good it would be a good meal, wouldn't it? Let's be honest. I can understand their desire to eat your nose.
Do you know what? At 16-year-old, mate, hearing that from a grown 30-odd-year-old man, I was terrified.
Not done badly for a former barman at the Dickens Inn in Middlesbrough, a well-known match day haunt, have you?
Nothing badly at all. I'd say my career's done all right from pouring pints and doing some cocktails.
Yeah. Did you ever used to work on Borough Match Day?
I used to work every weekend. I used to work Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and used to go in Sunday to clean. But then I used to play for Mask on a Saturday as well, and then you go straight from the game to work behind the bar.
Gotcha, that's what I meant. So you were playing Saturday football at the time, yeah. But you'd kind of, as soon as your game was over, you'd dash in and do the sort of evening stretch after.
Then I'd see half the lads out and I'm serving them.
half the Middlesbrough players are we talking about?
No, I'm talking about the Mask lads who I'd be playing.
Oh,
with.
The Mask lads, sorry. I thought you were about to dupe a load of professional footballers in it with the manager a few years ago. Or people would be going, is he talking about the Borough players? Well, they had a terrible season, and that's obviously why. I've got you.
This is the official EFL podcast.
I was just stating the obvious. Jordan Hugill's nose would make a decent-sized meal for any of us. At the beginning of April, the Papa John's Trophy final took place at Wembley Stadium, with Paul Warne's Rotherham United facing Matt Gray's Sutton United. Little did I know that Paul and Matt had never actually met each other until I introduced them a couple of days before the final. So it was a nice, touching moment as two new friends said their first words to each other. This Sunday, Wembley Stadium hosts the Papa John's Trophy final as Paul Warne's Rotherham United take on Matt Gray's Sutton United. And here on the official EFL podcast, we risk 15 minutes of dead air as both managers join us, but try and avoid giving away any state secrets. Matt, have your paths crossed before? You know what you're like, you managers getting together for seminars and baby kissing and things. Have you two met before?
I don't think it has, Paul, has it?
No. I would remember your handsome face if we'd met in public. I'm all about your hairstyle and that. So no, I don't think we've met. I don't think we've met on the side of the pitch. So no, it's a new one.
Right.
A new friend.
Here we are. I'm going to put you both right on the spot. Paul, what do you admire about Matt and his team?
Well, obviously, I've seen quite a bit of them recently. I went to watch them at Oldham last week, which killed me because they look very good. I like the fact that all the players know what they're doing. I like the fact that the defenders defend, the wide men attack. They've got pace out wide. I'm a big fan of that, as you well know. The centre forwards are prepared to drop in and they cause you problems. And I don't mean this rudely because people say this about my team, but it's quite uncomplicated. They all know what they're doing. They're well oiled. They obviously had a really good promotion season last year, got team of the year in the conference. And they've continued really well in the league above. And in fairness, they've got, as have we have, they're in a promotion push as well. So they just look a well-rounded group. And you know what I'm like, I'm not for big-time footballers, and they just look a together group. So congratulations on that, because it ain't easy to do.
Matt, if you haven't done the same level of due diligence, you're in the doo-doo, because I'm asking the same question of you.
I feel... Very detailed there, Paul. Very impressed. We haven't had the chance.
We haven't had a game for weeks.
Exactly. And we've been playing every Tuesday as well. So we haven't had the opportunity to come and see you guys live. But yeah, obviously doing tremendously well in the league. You know, you've been there many years and experienced manager at the level. Already won promotion from that league. So I'm sure they'll certainly be there or thereabouts. I don't want to tempt fate, so you're going to be a championship side just yet, because I know what that's like. Certainly there's many football to be played in the league yet. But again, a team very organised, fit, strong, got many threats, many ways to score a goal, and some very good individual players as well. So certainly a tough test coming up.
He may not have done the same level of research as Paul Warne, but I thought Matt Gray covered it well. Sunderland had been languishing in Sky Bet League One for far too many seasons for their fans' liking. So charged with the task of changing that was Alex Neil, who was appointed as manager in February. When we caught up about life at the Stadium of Light, I wanted to find out how he was handling the expectations and pressure. I'm guessing you knew what you signed up for. There is absolutely no hiding place whatsoever, is there? It is just constant when you're in the thick of it.
Yeah, but I think that's what attracted me to the role. You know, I took a very similar type job, albeit at a different level, at a different stage in the season at Norwich, you know, and it seemed to bring the best out in me and the best out in the team. So the difficulty I had then is with 25 games remaining, whereas with this one, there's likely to be 15, you know, and then obviously hopefully if we manage to get into the top six, into the playoffs, then you've got that to contend with. But I feel at home in that situation. You know, I've done it at Hamilton, I've done it at Norwich, and I think just the challenge, and like you say, the scrutiny and the pressure that comes with taking over a team like Sunderland and the expectancy is something that I was really eager to do.
Yeah, those two words you've just used, scrutiny and pressure, they were there right at your unveiling sort of press. You mentioned it, that you had no doubt about the players' abilities, but it was how they coped under scrutiny and pressure. Is that almost as important as dealing with the technical side of coaching the team, dealing with those expectations and getting inside the players' heads and telling them that they can be what you aspire them to be and can do it on a big stage?
It certainly is at a club like Sunderland. You know, I don't think there's many other clubs that are nominally like Sunderland in the fact that the club are in League One. You know, it's such a big club, it's such a big support, such a big stadium, all of that sort of stuff. So the pressures and the scrutiny that you talk about for the players is very different from most clubs. You know, I think I've experienced that since I've been here. I think every club, pretty much, probably apart from MK Dons, to be fair to them, have came and literally sat behind the ball. You know, so there's a huge pressure on our players to try and break that down. And not only that, you know yourself, when you play any game, the internal factors on the pitch in terms of technically playing well, coping with strategies and systems and formations is one thing, but we've got the external pressures as well. Which takes an elite mentality from the players to be able to block out and focus on the job.
This is the official EFL podcast.
And Alex Neil's appointment has proved to be a shrewd one for Sunderland. Congratulations to them on their return to the Sky Bet Championship. We heard from Mark Hughes a little earlier, and now for one of his former Manchester United teammates. In February, Paul Ince was unveiled as the interim manager of Reading, whose goal was that he keep them up. From the moment he took over, we wanted to get him on the official EFL podcast, but he said we'd have to wait until the job was done. So as you'd imagine, as soon as they were mathematically safe, we rang him up and he was happy to oblige. Is it a feeling of relief, Ince, that you feel?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, listen, I think, you know, when we first came into the job, me and Alex Ray, we knew it was going to be a tough challenge. You know, at the time, the team was averaging about 0.4 points a game, which is not stand-up material, to be fair. So we managed to get into 1.25. So there's been an increase in points. First, there's been in performances, I've got a lot better. And that's shown in the games that we've won, you know. So I think every time, you know, you have a challenge and you think about the ramifications if you do go down, you know, and it's not just, you know, the players, it's not the managers, it's not the, you know, you've got to think about the fans, you've got to think about the staff. You know, if you go into League One, then you know, you start cutting costs, there's redundancies, people lose their jobs, you know, people got families and kids to support. So there's a lot of pressure on myself as a manager to try and keep us in this league. So, yeah, to finally get there is a relief.
When you were appointed, you provided for me one of the quotes of the season when you said, I was at the back sink washing me sand wedge and when I got the phone call. At any point, did you have a moment where you thought, why on earth am I doing this to myself? Where you were trading the life of playing golf and all those lovely things with the incredible pressure and scrutiny of football management?
Yeah, there was plenty of those thoughts that went through my head. And no, you're absolutely right. I was, you know, on Saturdays, it's the competition day at Tenswell Golf Club. So, you know, I was looking forward to that. And then I got a phone call Friday evening. And all of a sudden, your mind just goes into a different kind of mindset. And all of a sudden, you start thinking, do you want to, am I that mad? Am I that stupid? That, do you want to go back into that? And, you know, and it took me, I mean, as much as I went to the Preston game on the Saturday, and then obviously Pranovic left on the Saturday after the game, and I was working on the training ground on the Sunday, and I was walking on the training ground, and I'm thinking, what am I doing? What am I doing? But football's my life. Football's my passion. You know, I love football, and I've, you know, and just the opportunity to go back and, you know, you always analyse a team, look at the players, what you got there, have you got a good chance, evaluate, have you got a good chance of staying up? And we had some very, very good players. This team last season finished 7th in the championship with the same squad, minus one or two players. So, you know, I always thought we had a chance of staying up. But yes, I did at times think, you know, 8 years out, no grey hairs, everything's nice, sleeping at night like a baby, and all of a sudden you wake up at 4 or 5 thinking about formations and, you know, if this happens to that team and, you know, but yeah, I've done it, so that's a good thing about it.
And despite questioning his own decision to swap golf for the stresses of football management, Paul Ince has now been given the Reading job on a permanent basis. We finish with one of the EFL's most extraordinary stories of the 2021-22 season, Fulham's Alexander Mitrovic banging in an incredible 43 goals for Fulham this campaign, breaking the record of Guy Whittingham, who scored 42 for Portsmouth in the 1992-93 season. Many, including Guy, thought the record would never be broken, but the machine like Mitrovic has written his name into the history books. So I asked Guy to sum up the magnitude of his success's achievement. I have to take you back to yourself. Do you know where your memorabilia is from that record-breaking season of your own? Do you ever sit down in a sort of quiet moment or when you're not having a great day and sort of watch your own goal montages? But I mean, they're being black and white, obviously, or maybe which film wasn't even invented back then. But do you kind of tap into your own past, or does it feel like a different person?
Yeah, the more reminded about it that you are, then you do tap into it and you remember certain things. I've got, when we went into COVID and all the Zoom started, I was up in my little study and I've got two boots. I've got a silver boot that was given to me for scoring the 42 league goals, and I've got another boot from Portsmouth for scoring the 47 goals in that season. So, your people always used to ask me about what are the boots for. So, but they're up in my study, and I actually got them out of the way. I didn't have them, you know, in the picture frame. I took them out of the way because I thought it's probably, you know, gone past now. But it's like I said, I've never had so much attention from the media, you know, even when I got the record back in 92-93. But yeah, and certainly, you know, with it being the topic of conversation, you know, certainly within the family and friends. You know, it's nice to be reminded of when things were going well.
We should finish by paying tribute to the man himself, the man that's nicked your record, Alexander Mitrovic. I mean, just an astonishing machine-like striker, Guy, is he not? It's just been a season that none of us will ever forget for him.
Yeah, I think the way he's played, not just his goal scoring, but the assists and the way, you know, I watched the game the other night and he was involved, you know, his movement, not just for himself, but for others as well. There was often he would take himself away from somewhere that he knew was going to be a danger area where another player could go. And that reminded me of what Paul Walsh used to do for me in that side that year. But his all round player, I think, has been, you know, fantastic this year, and it's a great achievement for him. Absolutely. I actually sent some personal congratulations to him via Lewis Boamorte, to say well done to him, because Lewis was on the course a couple of years ago. So I thought it'd be nice to do that. And hopefully that was passed on.
Guy, he might have taken your place in the record books, but we'll never, ever forget your contribution either. Really appreciate you joining us.
Thanks, Kemp.
That is it for this special episode of the Official EFL Podcast, and indeed for the 2021-22 season. A huge thanks to all of our guests who've joined us over the last 10 months, and we're already looking forward to talking to some of the biggest names from the Sky Bet Championship, League One and League Two when we return in July. If you've enjoyed this or indeed any of the episodes you've heard throughout the season, then please do give us a 5-star rating. Press the subscribe button and share on your socials. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. My name's Mark Clement, wishing you a relaxing summer, and we'll see you at the start of next season for a brand new episode of
The Official EFL Podcast.